Truvillion Next is a division of Truvillion, a financial services specialist search and talent advisory firm. Since inception, the Truvillion team has dedicated itself to enhancing the return on investment of a company's most important resource, its people.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Love, your co-moderator for today and head of banking and fintech at Truvillion, a boutique executive recruitment firm serving the financial services space since 1998. My division specifically covers community banks and other financial institutions around the country, assisting with succession planning and executive search for boards, executives, and senior leadership teams. Please connect with us on LinkedIn, Twitter, or YouTube, and visit our website at www.truvilliongroup.com to sign up for our mailing list and learn about our bank practice and current search engagements. My co-moderator is Truvillion's head of strategic advisory, Indra Alongavin. Indra, if you'd like to quickly say hello and introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Indra Alongavin. I'm head of strategic advisory, and my primary focus here at Truvillion is working with closely with boards and serving board advisory work.
Thank you, Indra. And our special guest today is Ted Rosinas, the managing director in investment banking at Stephens. Ted, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Happy to, and good, I guess, good afternoon, Brian and Indra. Thanks for having me. As Brian mentioned, managing director here in our Chicago office, Stephens is a privately owned, family-owned investment bank that has many verticals in the investment banking group, and the group I'm a part of is the depository team. Very briefly, started my career as an equity research analyst covering bank stocks, and then became an investment banker covering banks, and then was a part of a team that established two private equity funds that invested in the banking sector. I've sat on boards, obviously now an investment banker myself, and recently actually rejoined Stephens, where I had gone to work for a client for a couple years as head of corporate development and investor relations. So have certainly seen this industry from multiple angles and from different seats over several cycles. So it's great to be with you all.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. And we've talked for many years, so it's really great to pick your brain today. Obviously, the last year plus, and heading now into 2024 has been kind of a whirlwind for our clients, the community banks and other financial institutions that are, trying to kind of wade their way through the fogginess and understand, how to be the most strategic they can be, or hit pause and wait for, another day to fight. We're going to talk a little bit today around mostly M&A, but also other topics, including, what our board's talking about right now and focusing on. Obviously, Truvillion works in the talent space. How does talent factor into these things? And for our first question, I'll let Indra take the mic.
Thanks, Brian. Ted, for many financial institutions, their short-term attention has focused on navigating economic uncertainties and implementing strategies to preserve capital. What are you seeing and hearing from banks that are forward thinkers? What is at the top of their minds to remain ahead of their competitors from an M&A perspective?
Well, I think it's a challenge they're clearly grappling with every day. It's interesting. It's somewhat ironic. It's a foggy day here in Chicago, so I don't know if that's a harbinger of things to come or if the sun's on the horizon. I'm certainly a glass half full guy myself. Look, I think it's a couple things, Indra. The events of March in many ways crystallized for, I think, a lot of companies, a lot of banks, the importance of core funding and core funding that you thought was core turned out to be not that core. Since the Fed started increasing rates, we've seen hundreds of billions of dollars leave the banking system. That pressure in March was acutely on banks outside the four largest. And there's data to support that. And so I think forward thinking and strategic thinkers are certainly trying to figure out ways to, you know, combat or blunt the impact of those events from certainly happening again. I think there's a big focus right now on, and again, in light of this event in March, on the need for technology. And we saw in those days after the failures, just really how frictionless the banking industry and consumer deposit accounts has become. And so the need to invest more in technology for sure. The challenge there is we're never going to be able to, as an industry, outspend what the biggest institutions are spending in that area. And so I think a lot of bank management teams and boards are really spending a ton of time trying to figure out the chessboard and viewing really M&A as a way to, you know, enhance, you know, their standing and their ability to compete within this, you know, within the ecosystem. So it's, I would tell you for many months, and again, I just got back to Stevens in November, but, you know, when I was on the operating side, for many months, the outlook was so foggy and there were so many immediate needs that had to be addressed. You really weren't afforded the luxury of having the time to sit around and think kind of strategically over a multi-year period. I think as things have settled, and we've been in front of dozens of boards over the last 120 days, talking with them about strategic topics like this, that the fog is certainly lifting and they're getting back to kind of thinking over a multi-year strategic perspective. So.
Thanks, Ted. My next question for you is, what is the outlook and sentiment for banking M&A in 2024 and beyond?
Well, it's interesting. I think what you're going to see, okay, in the first half of this year is I think you will certainly see more transactions. You know, conversations. There's many conversations going on. I think we'll talk about the impact on balance sheet marks and rate environment and so on. And that's a big part here. But I think the outlook for the first half of this year is you'll see certainly some deals. They might have a more distressed flavor to them. I think one of the things that's important to remember and acknowledge is that the upcoming regulatory exams for banks is going to look and feel a lot different than the one they had last year. And so, you know, what happens on the back of those exams, depending on your bank's position, you know, could lend itself to having to pursue a transaction or find a partner. I think when we look out into the second half of 2024, again, one of the big limiting factors on M&A right now is just the interest rate marks that these balance sheets have on them, and it makes M&A can make M&A difficult. Passage of time helps that, and so we get into the second half of this year. I think when you look at kind of run rate M&A deals, it should be busier than the first half. We obviously have an election in November, which, you know, adds uncertainty and volatility. But the second half of this year is certainly setting up to be better than the first half. And, you know, 2025 has kind of all the makings of a very busy year. I think you will see companies whose balance sheets are structured well coming into this, who are clean from a credit perspective, and who, Indra, to your first question, have forced themselves to continue thinking strategically. I think you will see certain companies be really bold. I think you will. I certainly think there will be transactions that will be eye opening and you know, classified as bold. I think the First Sun Home Street deal last week, you know, is an example of that.
Yeah. Right. Fortune favors the bold, right, Ted?
Well, it does, and it particularly, right? I mean, there's a great you know, bifurcation right now. I mean, there are certainly there are many banks whose balance sheet issues, you know, are not as significant as others. And those companies have the optionality to think that way, Brian. You know, you can go back and look over multiple cycles, but you know, being bold and transacting earlier in recoveries, if you will, from a shareholder return perspective, actually is better than quote unquote waiting for a headline multiple number. And I think there are certainly boards who are thinking that way.
So Ted, yeah. I have a follow-up question to your points. Yeah. Like from what I hear and read, acquisitive banks are likely to incorporate some creative capital market capabilities into the due diligence process. Are banks pairing acquisitions with balance sheet restructuring or changes as they look for M&A strategic opportunities?
Oh, of course, for sure. And I would tell you that most of the transactions that, you know, we're evaluating incorporate some form of what, you know, I'll call balance sheet optimization. I mean, and the beauty of M&A, I mean, is the whole balance sheet obviously gets marked. And that's what most of these companies, right? I mean, they can't absorb these marks today on their own. And so, you know, whether it's liquidating the securities portfolio and paying down borrowings, you know, looking at other avenues, yes, for sure. And I would tell you what also is a recent development, and our confidence level around this is high, is that for the right transaction, so a well-structured, well-intentioned kind of strategic deal, there is institutional investor capital available to come in to that transaction. And you saw that last week on the First Sun Home Street deal. But I would, you know, I would tell you that from, you know, from our position, from our seat, that that there is available capital to support a transaction and to help mitigate some of the balance sheet mark issues.
Thanks. With that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Yeah, Ted, I mean, you know, Trevilian's wherewithal, I always say this is, you know, executive search and succession planning. And I heard you mention technology and regulatory as being, you know, kind of lightning rods right now for banks to deal with. You know, exams are going to be quite different. You mentioned, you know, kind of scaling and technology and how that creates issues. And so I kind of sit back and think to myself, there's talent at banks that needs to help mitigate those things. And sometimes you don't have it. So I wanted to relate talent to M&A. So like, how does M&A change talent strategy? And then how does talent strategy, you know, in essence, sometimes created by M&A? What have you seen?
Yeah. Well, I think succession is clearly, I think it's a challenge that our industry has faced for years. It's why folks like Trevilian are such, you know, incredibly important partners, right? Because we just know that new college grads, right, aren't coming into the banking and finance industry, right? They'd rather go work at Google and I guess it's called Meta now and other places that aren't our industry. And look, I was talking to a CEO the other day, and we were kind of lamenting that we've had three crises in 15 years, and we're all 15 years older. And we both joked that the best quote to sum that up is Sergeant Murtaugh's quotes from Lethal Weapon. And I'll let your listeners go research what that is. But there's a lot of that, Brian. And so I think when you're having significant succession events, right? It's always, I think, instructive and important to step back and say, okay, you know, is there succession achieved also through M&A. And I think sometimes that's underappreciated. You know, as shareholder owned companies, if you're looking at changing out your senior executive team because of retirement or otherwise, that's also the moment where you need to be evaluating whether or not partnering for succession is a viable, you know, alternative path to consider. So we do, Brian, we get brought in a lot when these types of questions are being brought up. And look, invariably that's not the path that boards select. But it certainly does happen.
Yeah.
It's hard though. I mean, you tell me. I mean, I would almost throw the question back to you, right? I mean, you all place executives all over the banking industry, geographically agnostic. I mean, what have you felt?
Yeah, I mean, well, luckily, you know, I've been doing this 8 years, and we've made almost from day one. You know, I'm 45 years old. I'll be 46 this year. I made it my duty to try and find a really nice stable of folks in my age group that can like grab the torch, right? So while a lot of folks will tell you that, you know, the succession candidates just aren't there, they are, but a lot of them are not where you think they'll be. You know, if you're looking for that lender that moves up the ranks and knows everyone in the hometown, those people are, you know, they're not prevalent. They're retiring too at this point. But if you're looking for someone who really understands strategy, who might come from a CFO rank, or gosh, dare I say, we have one bank considering almost like a CTO to be their CEO. And then, you know, I just think that's like the new point of succession planning, is understanding that the next 25 years has almost nothing to do with the previous 25 years in terms of true leadership competencies. I'm over dramatizing. But the ones that really, like you said, are bold in their thinking are the ones that really, I think, are standing out to me. That's my thought. So, yeah, for what it's worth. I don't know if you have a response to that.
No, I mean, I think that's right. You know, there was a, you know, Howard Marks, you know, the great investor, he does an annual letter that's, I think is up there with, you know, must read annual letters from, you know, Warren Buffett, and Jamie Dimon and others. But his letter last year was called Sea Change. And the core thesis of his thing was what exactly what you just said, what worked in the last 30 years, okay, is not going to work in the next 30 years. And I think you're right. I think you can be bold in your M&A strategy. I think you can be bold in how you think about succession.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and also,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah.
I agree, Ted. And you have to be bold in your business lines, right? You know, mm-hmm. funding, mm-hmm. you mentioned funding and how important it is, and it's not what it was. And, you know, a lot of these banks need to rethink that as well. In any event,
I mean, the relationship is there's a lot less friction around these deposit relationships than I think we all appreciated coming into March, right? I mean, just think about how you engage with your own bank, right? It's very easy now to transfer money or set up a new account. And if your company's not set up to be able to do that, you know, you're exposed. Mm-hmm. And you know, is a core deposit what it was? You know, no, it's I think it's all around relationship focus, right? And I think that's where I think those who've outperformed from a deposit flows perspective are banking entire relationships, not merely, you know, renting their balance sheets and so on. And what's interesting though, Brian, and I think this often gets lost, but if you look at, and this is all in the Fed's H8 data, so anyone can go pull it. But if you look at the percentage of deposits that are in small commercial banks in the US, and that's any bank outside of the top 25, that's how the Fed will define that. the share of deposits in those institutions is at 30%. It's actually a little more than 30%. And it's been rising every year since the great financial crisis, right? And so what you've seen, you saw it during COVID, you saw it during the GFC a little bit, you saw it obviously in March, but when there's times of stress, money leaves the smallest institution and goes to the bigger ones, right? It's kind of quote unquote flight to safety. Although I would argue that ad nauseum that that's not true. From a safety perspective. And then the money does ultimately come back. And so I think there's an interesting question that the industry is facing now is a bunch of money's gone to the big four and it's left for, you know, it's gone outside the banking system into money market funds and so on. You know, are you ready? Are you set up to get your share of that, of those deposits when the money does come back into the system? It's an interesting question. You know, Each bank is going to have a different answer to that. Technology is a big piece of it.
Oh yeah. Agreed on that. Thanks. You know, the tech linking tech there at the end, I totally agree. It's delivery and how people bank and, you know, now and in the future. I want to go back to
it's
one other thing,
you know?
Yeah.
I feel like there's an Amazon package on my front step every day. And that's a topic for a separate discussion, but just think about how we do everything. Right. And so you just, it's just to your point, it's the next 30 is going to be different than the prior 30.
Definitely. By the way, I got to give you kudos to your Lethal Weapon, Danny Glover earlier, man.
Well, he's forever known as Sergeant Murtaugh in my house. So
there you go. I want to go back though. You had referenced, I will ask you your favorite movie, so keep that in mind as we finish here in a minute. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the First Sun deal with Home Street and how institutional PE got involved in that deal. I just wanted you to maybe elaborate a little bit more around, you know, how you interact with private equity, especially in 2024, and how do you see private equity investments playing out this year?
Well, I'll let the private equity guys speak to that. I mean, we clearly have what I view as very dynamic and strong kind of two-way relationship with private equity funds that traffic in our space. But I think what you're seeing kind of more broadly, Brian, and again, I don't, it's going to be transaction specific, right? Mm-hmm. Not every M&A deal, okay, is going to be structured or viewed in a manner that is either sometimes it doesn't need capital, or it may not be done in such a way that investors or institutional investors want to get behind it. And there can be any number of reasons for that. But I think what's kind of the broader point here is that, you know, inside a well-structured M&A deal, there is institutional money available to help offset some of the challenges that are going to come from marking, the balance sheet. And, you know, if you go back and you think about investor sentiment, we come out, our research group comes out with an investor survey. I think they do it probably a couple times a year. And you go back and you look at how the sentiment was going in, you know, in last year it was tough, right? And then March happens and it got really tough, a lot of volatility. Right. Most forecasters were dead wrong on the directionality and level of interest rates. Right. Credit fears were seeping in. It was really hard. You couldn't model net interest margins, deposit. No one knew what deposit betas were going to be. You throw in the events of March and it's just you couldn't. I mean, it was no one cared. Right. I mean, generally speaking, the buy side was underweight the banking industry. I think what's changed now is there's a general consensus around that the Fed is done hiking, and that the Fed will be cutting. There's an interesting dynamic inside of that, though, because the Fed dot plot has three cuts for this year. Anyone can go look it up. You look at the forward, you know, the futures market, and it's anywhere. The market says that the Fed's going to settle out between 4 and 4.25. Well, that's 5 or 6 cuts. There's a big chasm between those two forecasts, right? And so rates are coming in, right? But to what level, I think, is a big question. But I think generally speaking, buy side's more comfortable modeling kind of a rate scenario, right? And understanding what NIMs are going to look like. The credit piece is still, you know, to be determined. I mean, we're looking at earnings right now, right? We're in the middle of earnings season. I would tell you that for the most part, credit is still pristine. I mean, NPAs compared to last quarter for all those who have reported is up 2 basis points.
Yeah.
Right. The internal migration within various risk ratings or, you know, increase in classifieds is if up, it's not increasing at close to anything that would be, you know, concerning. Right. So credit's really clean. You're seeing it crack in credit cards a little bit. Right. Delinquencies are back to their kind of May 2020 highs in credit cards, but not a lot of banks that we traffic in have credit card exposure. Right. And then you have office. So I think I'm giving you all that, and office is obviously an issue, right? I mean, there's a data provider that tracks, you know, the key cards you scan to get into office buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a company called Castle that makes those cards or tracks that data. And they come out weekly with occupancy reports across a 10-city market, okay, and they average it out. And you know, well, I was looking at this actually this morning, and the average occupancy, okay, in the month of January right now, and there's been some bad weather, but across that 10-city metro grouping is 46% occupancy based on key card swipes. The lowest day in a given week is 33%, and the highest day is 58%. Okay, office loans were not underwritten with that as the occupancy model, right? So there's going to be pockets, but investors, I think, feel as if they've kind of honed in and isolated where the likely problems are going to be. So that clarifies the outlook, right? And I think there's a general conviction that M&A is going to increase, and that for the right type of transaction, that is a good place to invest some dollars. And it makes sense to me, right? It's been years now, but I throw my old investor hat on. Half of the balance sheet that you own is fully marked, right?
Yeah.
And can be liquidated to you know, again, we talked about earlier, to implement some balance sheet optimization strategies. So again, deal specific, but I think there's certainly more interest from institutional investors than there was, you know, 6 months ago, because the outlook's gotten a little clearer.
Sure. Thanks, Ted, for that. And I want to bring it back to Indra here for our final question, and then we can wrap up thereafter. Go ahead, Indra.
Ted, what are community bank boards buzzing about right now?
Well, I think I just hit on most of it. It's really this. I think there's certainly discussions around what we just talked about, rates, right? Directionality, credit, challenges on deposit growth. That's a big one. Right. Deposit growth is a really big, it's a really big question. It's really hard. You know, I think a lot about, if you just remember mailers you got around the time of the failures, everyone was offering a 7 and 11 month CD special. Well, 7 and 11 months from the March, June timeframe is kind of now, right? Or it's starting to be now. And so, you know, I think deposit growth is certainly a big area. M&A, as we've talked about, I think it's what's interesting, and I'll go back, Indra, to one of the first comments I made around we'll see transactions that will be eye-opening, and we're going to have there are going to be people that are going to be bold. You know, what happens when the offset to that or the downside to that, if you're an institution who viewed your exit or your liquidity path as a sale to a partner, is you can lose an upstream partner, or in the event of a merger, you can lose two in a single day. And so there are a lot of boards out there buzzing and trying to figure out, again, what the chessboard is going to look like and how do they fit into it. And I would tell you that that's probably the flavor of the month in the boardrooms that I've been in since being back at Stevens. Really taking an acute focus on that.
Great, thanks. Just staying on the M&A topic, there is a growing gap between merger announcement and closing. What are the factors in play for that extension of this process?
Oh, it's all regulatory. It's all regulatory. There used to be a period where you could have a couple M&A applications pending at the same time. I even had a couple clients announce two deals simultaneously on the same day. And so that world no longer exists. And you then layer on I hate to keep going back to March, but it was a significant event for our industry, but also for the regulators, I have to imagine. Particularly, considering when you add up those four bank failures, I think I saw a stat that those four equaled all the failures from the Great Financial Crisis. Brian, you may have to check that, but it's close enough. And so heightened scrutiny. Most applications, Indra, are being sent to Washington, D.C. for review. There was a period of time where you could get review and approval within your region. Mm-hmm. That's the exception, no longer the rule. And then the last thing I would tell you is, as long as your merger application is open, you know, the regulators are you know, they're looking at everything, right? So it's, you know, if you don't have your compliance in your BSA world in order and so on and so forth, I mean, there's things that can come up inside of an approval process, that certainly can extend and elongate the approval time. And maybe the last thing I'll leave you with is, if the target has any issues, particularly in the compliance area, again, BSA, AML, so on, that deal is very unlikely to get approved until that issue is resolved.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, my last question is the favorite movie question. Ted, what's the favorite movie?
I quoted an 80s cop movie. And you're going to be surprised to hear that's probably not my favorite. If I had a favorite movie, it's not going to be anything original. Probably The Godfather or Casablanca.
Ooh, AFI is like top 10 right there. You got, that's pretty cool. yeah. Well, thanks for playing the
nothing original.
That's okay. Yeah. They're fantastic, fantastic movies. So Ted, we've reached the end, and you're an amazing advisor to community banks in this space. Really appreciate you letting us, get your perspective on things today. Thank you so, so much for your time, and look forward to future interactions with you.
No, absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Yeah. Well, I hope you both have a wonderful rest of your day, and thanks for having me on.